Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore. Grab your glasses of scotch, although for some of you from the Eastern Hemisphere, Western, I should say, you're probably on to beer at this point in the day. Put your chair up to the fire, because we're going to learn some cool shit tonight, courtesy of a personal hero of mine, none other than Brian Forrester. We're going to be discussing the DNA testing of the elongated skulls of Pacaras that he has been working on with L.A. Marzulli for, well, the last, pretty well since it has been really looked at. He's been trying to get these done. And there is a huge reveal that will be done in L.A. on the 2nd of February, and we are the first show that's going to be able to discuss these goings-ons with him. And it's a great honor and pleasure to have him on the show. And he is a man with no need for introduction. Everyone does know him. He is a fantastic personality and individual and researcher in the field of alternative history, and somebody whom I believe is one of the most incredible individuals when it comes to South American lost civilizations. I did want to be able to mention that this is going to be a fantastic afternoon for all those who are going to be joining us. If you are listening to this on iTunes or on Google Radio, tune in, or on Stitcher, or any of our syndications such as Deprogrammed Radio, and I do believe we're going to be on Into the Void soon, or they're a major publication and broadcast, so you can check that out there. And if you are listening in at that time, thank you very much for joining us. Now, one thing I did want to be able to mention is, for this show, as you do know, it is free to consume, but we do have a very, very good cadre of individuals who donate to the show via Patreon. Those patrons are the reason why the show exists and why we can be 100% sponsor-free, ad-free, and 100% listener-supported, which essentially means we can say whatever the hell we want on air without somebody telling us, no, you can't say that, no, you can't do that, no, that point of view is not something that can be shown. And if you have that on air because it is controversial, we will pull your funding. And we want to make sure that you, the listeners and the viewers out there, are continuously given the most cutting-edge information available. And to a special thanks goes to our illustrious masters, Jackie Smith, Jackie from across the pond, Pat from Brooklyn, to our masters, Lee Veltman, Ronnie Schultz, Antonio Martinez, Frederick Johnson, Jared Thompson, and Mrs. Fox, Roses, Wayne, Joshua E. Matic, Eleanor Curdy, Nicholas, my cousin, thank you very much for supporting the show. It's awesome. I'm glad you like it. Craig Yurt, Charles Davis, Dobromir Reynov, Mark Catalano, Thiel Gabara, Michael Eckhoff, Dean John Kendrit, Anthony Derry, Atlantic Kush, Venice from Magical Egypt, Sentient, Christopher Moody, and Robin Weebly. Whew. Man, that list gets longer and longer every single week. So, Brian, thank you very much for joining us on the program, and I see that Coco is so excited for the show that she wants to join us as well. And let's start this at a very logical starting point. The Pacaras skulls are, or the elongated skulls, are a fixture within the alternative history community. From anyone who is a believer in the ancient aliens theory to those who believe in Atlantis, how did these artifacts first get discovered?
Sorry, there's music playing. Oh. Ah, there we go. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, now I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Are you able to hear me now?
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about that. The Pacaras skulls, the elongated skulls, have been a fixture in the alternative history community, as well as from anybody who is interested in ancient alien theory to even something just as basic as a logical basis for Atlantis. How did these skulls first get discovered? What are they?
Well, my discovery of them was I saw photographs on TV shows when I was much younger, stating that they were Nephilim or hybrids or aliens or whatever. But my first physical encounter was here in Paracas in Peru when my friend Senior Juan Navarro, he had has a little museum, and my wife and I walked in there one day and we saw this mummified, elongated head. And I was fascinated by it. And he said, oh, I have more at home if you'd like me to bring them to show you. And I went, that sounds great. And coming from a biological background, I was amazed at the shape because some of them appeared to be so natural looking that I don't and didn't think that they were examples of headboarding or cranial deformation. And there's almost no literature whatsoever on the internet or in academic circles about these ancient people. So that's why I took it on myself to figure out who these people were.
Now, the peoples themselves, they occupy a very large area of the planet's surface, even though the land masses themselves may be relatively small. I've been watching your work, as well as multitude of your lectures from Open Minds Conference, for instance, Megalithomania, and you have mentioned on a few occasions the Polynesian Triangle. Now, exactly how does that fit into the skull mythos? Is there a basis of travel that people had arrived to the southern continent from?
Well, the curious thing, and again, because there's so little academic material except about the textiles these people made, they almost no attention to their the size of their heads, the fact that the royal people had dark red hair, not the black hair of Native Americans. I was also able to find out that they averaged 5'10" to 6 feet tall, which is very big for an ancient Peruvian. And also, if you have darkish red or reddish hair, you tend to have very light skin and possibly blue or green eyes. So those are characteristics that don't fit in at all with the standard Bering Land Bridge movement of people from Siberia. And since I'd studied a lot in Polynesia, in Hawaii, and other places, I heard stories that there were ancient people that had reddish hair and light skin who were encountered in New Zealand, Tahiti, and Hawaii, and Easter Island. So that's where the Polynesian Triangle comes in. So it's been a process of trying to figure out that obviously these people didn't spontaneously evolve on the coast of Peru from local native people. So the only possibility that I've been able to come to is that they obviously migrated from somewhere else, and they would have to at least have gone through Polynesia in order to get to the coast of Peru.
Now, the eddies in the Pacific Ocean and the currents have been proven to have been able to transport boats over extended lengths and distances. I know one of the prevailing theories has been that they were island hopping. The other one is that they came down along the coast in shallow reed areas, which I never thought made much sense. But there seems to have been multiple landings at, or at least possible landings. Is it possible that they came to either Bolivia or Peru first, and then, let's say, traveled somewhere else and then came back at a later time?
It's possible. The interesting thing is there's a lady who lives in New Zealand. The native New Zealand people are called the Maori, and they're of Polynesian heritage. So that means they're, you know, in general, they're quite stocky, dark skin, brown eyes, black wavy hair, but she has red hair and it's genetic. And so she had her DNA tested, and it turns out that 30% of her DNA is Persian. So you're talking about major complications in migration. Also, we have building evidence that ancient people traveled not only to the Pacific coast of South America, but also the Atlantic side too. And it's quite possible that ancient people both sailed to the coast of Peru, but also sailed up the Amazon River and got to the deep into the jungle, and then climbed over the Andes to get into places like Cusco in Peru. So the story is very complex.
And I know that some people will try and fit the story of the Anunnaki or the Watchers, or they will use some type of other mythology to try and place the elongated skulls into some type of paradigm that makes sense. And I know that you're somewhat of a researcher and have colleagues that are researchers of giant mythos as well. It's also a guilty pleasure of mine. And there are numerous reports of red-haired giants in North America, in the Ohio Valley, on the west coast of the United States. Is there any relation between the two, or is this something that is more like, well, red hair is, red hair is a characteristic, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if red hair is here, it has to be the same people there.
Yeah, we aren't sure yet. L.A. Marzulli is doing a lot of work with the Nephilim and the giants, and Hugh Newman's and Jim Vieira are doing a lot of work with the giants. The problem so far is because of the cover-up in the 19th century of giant remains that were found that are probably now in the Smithsonian warehouses, DNA, as far as I know, has not been recovered in order to do a comparison. So we are at the beginning stages of this. Once they are able to get, if they can get giant DNA, then we can do a comparison of the practice with them and see if there's a relationship. But in general, in ancient history, red hair and dark red hair tend to be signs of nobility. You find that in Israel, in the Middle East, Ireland, Scotland, Scandinavia, etc. But finding them on the west coast of Peru 2,000 plus years ago, if nothing else, that shatters the idea that the only migration to Peru came from people crossing the Bering Land Bridge and walking their way down thousands of miles. So it's pretty earth-shattering evidence.
And at the same time, it would also potentially be indicative of the types of architecture that are found worldwide. I know that, let's say, in the Temple of Osiris, or what's termed the Temple of Osiris, there are megalithic blocks which are shaped together using very similar styles, which are found in Japan and found in Peru even. Seeing those types of DNA markers in let's say from the Persian region, or at least that part of the world, and actually also seeing it in Peru, and seeing the same architecture, it lends somebody to think that it's possible at least that there is some type of connection. Why do you think that there's been such a pushback from the archaeological community? At least I know that there has been less recently. The main theory, which was the Bering Land Bridge crossing, that is starting to gain the alternate theories are starting to gain more prominence within that community, but you're still finding resistance. From your perspective, are you still seeing it in Peru from the archaeological community, or is it the same there as it is in the United States?
There actually is not a lot of archaeological activity that's going on in Peru these days, much less than previously. I think the most important aspect is we've depended too long on one small group of people to tell us what the historical record is, as in archaeologists and anthropologists. And so that's why I've been very active with engineers and stonemasons and other fields of related interest, engineers, people, geologists, people like that. And once you get their statements, then the standard archaeological story that the dynastic Egyptians built the Great Pyramid, or that the Inca built the megalithic works in Peru, just simply fall apart, because they didn't have any type of level of technology that could possibly do this. It doesn't matter how many people they had employed, the tool set they had, which is bronze chisels and stone hammers, doesn't work anymore. And so I think there's a quietness in academia about this, because the evidence is becoming completely overwhelming.
I think the only alternate theory that I've been able to hear from with regards to stone tools and chisels, or even shaping of stone, was actually from someone who's considered a renegade archaeologist, even in the Egyptology field, which is I'm actually trying to remember where I heard the story. But I know that what was mentioned to me was that, okay, well, instead of saying, well, it was shaped over a short period of time, the person postulated, well, it could have been done over, you know, let's say 20 or 30 years, that one craftsman may have had, you know, his entire working life working on this, just this one piece, which at least is something that's a little more credible than, no, it was done within, you know, a couple of weeks with a stone saw and some abrasive sand, and that's how they got through it.
Right.
And even with some of the work that you found in, you know, whether in, I'm not mistaken, it wasn't in Machu Picchu, but it would have been in Egypt, where the boreholes within solid granite and diorite, and I think even in, I'm trying to remember all the names of all the sites, but these were using very high vibration boring tools, which you had stated. Mm-hmm. What are the people's stories that they're saying that they had gotten here from, and do they account for this type of high technology or even just basic technology being around? Or is their methodology of saying this is how we got here just about the journey?
Well, the important thing is to take someone like an engineer. We've had mining engineers from Australia with us who use drill, like hollow core drill bits embedded with diamond. And when they look at the profile of some of these drill holes in Egypt, they say that's about 500 times as efficient as the tools I use. So you're not even talking modern technology being used in the distant past. You're talking about technology that we don't even have. And when they use ideas like copper saws with quartz sand as an abrasive, again, when you have an engineer or a machinist with you, they completely discount that, because the problem is that the quartz sand is the same material as the quartz which is inside the granite. So you're trying to cut something with the same hardness as the stone itself, which means you're not going to move very quickly at all. Actually, the two materials basically neutralize each other. And copper, you know, copper is a very soft material. So the Egyptians, up until the 8th century BC, and taking into account that even Egyptologists believe the Great Pyramid was built 2500 BC, the hardest tools they had were bronze chisels, which is about 3.5 out of 10 in hardness. And the Inca never showed any evolution of tool technology up until the time of the Spanish, which was the 16th century, when steel was introduced. So you have these Bronze Age cultures who could not possibly have done things like the Osirion in Egypt, or the Great Wall of Sacsayhuaman in Peru, where you have 120-ton blocks. So the more that we research it, the more we bring other experts in from different parts of the world, the more the standard story is simply collapsing.
And this would also coincide with stories of migration as well. If I'm not mistaken, the boats in Lake Titicaca are constructed with reeds, which are found there as well as on the island of Rapa Nui only, are essentially the same construction, or very similar construction, to the boats that were found in Egypt, which are still ocean-faring. So mm-hmm. It still goes to ask, okay, well, is it the same based on coincidence? Is it the same based on design? And are the levels of technology, is the construction, the DNA that's found, as well as the craftsmanship that is still being used today, which is found in both places, is there a connection? And, you know, I know we've discussed certain areas in Peru and Bolivia, but Rapa Nui seems to be one of the, and for all of the listeners out there, Rapa Nui is the native name for Easter Island, which I know some of even our adepts have been themselves. And the craftsmanship of the Moai statues are, I'm going to say absolutely flat, but absolutely baffling to somebody like myself. Especially when you realize that there is an entire body buried beneath the beneath the ground.
Yeah.
And a mutual acquaintance of ours, Dr. Robert Schock, has done postulating on the dates there. And some of the dates go back a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So can you clarify more on the dating as well as the peoples that could have been there, and how that can account for not just something that's, let's say, 1,000 years old, but, you know, could be up to 12,860 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Or older.
Well, yeah, well, one point is that the Totora reed is found in Lake Titicaca. It's also found up right here, like I'm several hundred feet from a lot of Totora reed. So it's found on the coast of Peru and also in Rapa Nui. And also when you look at the language, you see interesting things like the little craft they still make on Rapa Nui, which is for one person, is called a pora. And the ones made on the coast of Peru are called a tora. So likely it's the same thing. And if you have that material on the coast of Peru, you can construct a boat, if you wanted, 300 feet long out of Totora, and you could sail to Rapa Nui, which would be your entry point into the Pacific Ocean and the rest of the world. So as regards Robert Schock, yeah, we were actually there with him, which was great, about 4 years ago. And his great expertise is weathering of stone. That's mm-hmm. why he was able to redate the Sphinx. So when we visited probably 7 or 8 or 10 sites, and both he and I noticed two distinct styles of construction. There was a megalithic style without any mortar, and all of those sites looked like they were damaged by some kind of cataclysm. And then the Polynesian style, which is stacking rocks on top of another, as well as with the moai, which are the figures, as you mentioned, the head sticking out of the ground is not the whole sculpture. The bodies go all the way down. One of them is about 40 feet tall. So he noticed, in terms of weathering and style, two very distinct designs. The smaller ones had flatter noses and looked like they were Polynesian, and also Polynesian in manufacturing or construction. But then the bigger ones with the more angular noses, more European style or maybe Asian or Middle Eastern style noses, those were much bigger and much more finely done. And he had no problem in stating that he thought some of that work was at least 12,000 years old, based on weathering.
And at that point in time, obviously, the sea level was about 300 to 400 feet lower than it currently is today. And again, not getting too woo here, the idea that the Central Pacific, there's a large chain of islands there. with water down that low, there's a very good chance that the islands could have been connected, or there could have been a much larger landmass that was there, which may have attributed to stories of Mu or even of Atlantis, if that were the case. And if you are a follower of Earth sciences or of geological history, I know that theories based on the work of researchers such as Graham Hancock or Randall Carlson have at least gone through the logical process of saying, okay, well, this is how during the last ice age that there could have been land masses in, let's say, the middle of the Atlantic, making these stories, or at least the legends of these places existing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the legends that I'm always at least starting to look into is the legends of the peoples of Hawaii and how that there were individuals that had come during, let's say, the 1600s or 1400s, but there were peoples that were there and they claimed to have been there for 25,000 years. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I lived on Maui for 2 years, and so I had access to the old Hawaiian aunties, who are the great storytellers. They carry the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. There's also a great book which you can still get called Tales from the Night Rainbow. And that's an oral tradition account. And so what they state is that the Tahitians arrived probably, I think, in the 1200s AD. And they, like, you know, big Polynesian people, but they encountered a much more peaceful race there called the Mu, or it's been altered in modern times. They're called Menahuni, but the ancient name is the Mu, as in Mu Lemuria. And they supposedly had been there for forever. And like with a lot of contact of one culture to another, they were decimated to some degree and also interbred with the arriving Tahitians. And that's why to this very day, there are people who live in Hawaii especially on the island of, what's it called? Ka'o'ola Bay, and the west coast of Kauai, mm-hmm. who have dark red hair. And they trace their ancestry back to the pre-Tahitian people.
And how is this a connection to places like Nan Madol, which some people were claimed to have been made within the last several hundred years, but it still doesn't account for giant multi-ton basalt rocks being, you know, taken across open water to a remote location to all of a sudden build this magical city?
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, when we have the tours, mm-hmm. part of the function of the tours, of course, is to make money. But what I love more is getting people of expertise to come with me. So we've had shipwrights with us, and when you explain the story, the standard stories of, well, the Egyptian obelisks were carried down the Nile on giant, you know, reed boats, or the stones of Pumapunku were brought across Lake Titicaca by people who made reed boats. They just break out laughing because they say, you can't build something that can carry 40 or 100 tons without sinking out of reeds. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So maybe I just lost the train of thought there. But another point I did want to make is, you were talking about the it's scientific fact now that 12,000 years ago, the entire oceans of the world were 300 feet lower than they are today. And so when you look at a topographical map of Hawaii, the islands of Lanai, Ko'olawe, all of the islands basically would have been connected to each other, except maybe Big Island. But that 12,000 years ago would be a big land mass. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where the Mu reference is. I think Hawaii was actually Mu, and some of the Hawaiian elders have told me they, you know, we don't believe this idea that the Tahitians came here and they were solely our ancestors. We're the ones who went there first. So again, going back to your statement of inhabitation on the Hawaiian Islands, possibly 25,000 plus years ago.
And how does this connect to, let's say, the Pakaras people or the Viracochas? The Viracocha, because that word can be used as a term for Viracocha himself or his followers. So mm-hmm. is there a connection between the Paracas people and the Viracocha, or are these potentially two completely distinct groups or peoples?
That's really hard to know. The important point, and again, this comes from learning from local knowledge, like the best thing is local knowledge. It's not from some academic text of supposition, blah, blah, blah. But Viracocha is the name of the creator god. So Viracocha was and is, maybe, an invisible deity. But he sent his children, called the Viracochan, or the Viracochan, to be great teachers. And the little that's known about them now is that they were supposedly very tall. They came from a very distant land where I believe where the sun set. It's either they came from the land where the sun sets or the land where the sun rises. And they were supposedly light-skinned, very tall, very intelligent. And they spent a limited time with the local people of Peru in order to educate them in regards to agriculture, metallurgy, you know, all the sciences and arts. And they departed from the north coast of Peru, where the border with Ecuador is. But another interesting twist is Viracocha means the foam of the sea. And supposedly the story is they left behind the foam of the sea. But another twist on the story is that when they arrived, they said, "We come from the foam of the sea," maybe hinting that their landmass had sunk.
And knowing that even the imagery of the Viracocha is seen throughout South America, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rich Cassaro's work. He's found the he's found the same imagery of the Viracocha, or even Quetzalcoatl. All throughout the Adriatic, not the Adriatic. I'm Croatian, so I always go to the Adriatic as the main as the main sea there.
The I can understand why. I spent a month in Dubrovnik and loved it.
Goodness, the weather, the food, the women.
Oh, all of the above.
Thank goodness my wife does not listen or watch this show.
Good.
She's like, we're not going back home. with this imagery being seen throughout there, I'm going to touch on Göbekli Tepe just because every single time we say that, everyone takes a shot at some point. Then when I mess up a name. So thankfully, I have to give the people just a little bit of a taste today. The hand signals around the buried statues of Easter Island, where it's situated around the navel. That same style of placement around the navel is seen at Göbekli Tepe.
Right.
As well. And I'm going to use it as somewhat of a transition into the next subject matter, which is the testing of the skulls, which I know that is something that and I'm going to be able to link back to that statement as well, which is pretty cool. With the current connection to the native peoples, the testings that you performed beforehand, I know that there were two sets of testings. One is being announced on the second, and you've done one which you recently released. And you sent me the video this afternoon. I'm just going to try and see if I can bring that up. But that was from colleagues of yours, which had documented the entire process. So what did you find as far as a connection to the current peoples that are there? And is there a were you surprised by the first set of testing?
Yeah, I was. Marzulli and I and the others involved in those tests. Unfortunately, there were only four samples because of circumstances. But the DNA results came from hair, and the hair was sterilized, as in all the surface was clean, like it was a kind of detergent or acetone or something that was used in the professional lab in order to remove any bacteria, any fingerprints, anybody breathing on the samples or anything like that. So there's no way there was any contamination. But the results that showed up were not Native American in all four samples whatsoever. One of the results was U2E1, which is Scandinavia. And then another was H1, which is the Middle East and Eastern Europe. And the other one was H2B, I think, which again is that same kind of area. So those three samples showed no Native American characteristics or haplogroups whatsoever. And so that's why the release we'll be doing on February 2nd is very impossible, because there, I think, or is very important, because there, I think, there are something like 30 or 40 samples. L.A. Marzulli won't tell me because he knows I'll blab it all over the internet beforehand, but he's hinted to me that the sample size is at least 10 times of what we did before, and the results are showing the same kind of patterns. I'm also going to be presenting some blood type data, which I was recently given, and that again indicates not 100% Native American, because all people pre-Columbian, from Mexico all the way down to the southern tip of South America, were 100% type O. And that, again, goes with the theory of crossing the Bering Land Bridge and walking through Canada, then the United States, then Mexico, and through Central America to get to South America. But the results from these two studies are that, if nothing else, these ancient Paracas people were a very complicated ethnic mix of people from different parts of the world, 1,500 years before Columbus discovered America.
And with you had a very large team, and I know that watching the video that you had sent me, and I sat there in reverence and awe, because you had mentioned that the team just started to grow and started to gain just steam with the amount of expertise that was brought on, such as, well, there was yourself, there's Dr. Ilya Marzulli. I know that Mono Gonzalez was also involved. You had several individuals. One of them was actually a forensic expert that you brought mm-hmm. on, which bagged and tagged everything as if it were a crime scene to make sure that there was no contamination of the samples.
Mm-hmm. Which exactly,
and to me that shows a level of transparency, and it shows a level of credibility that we may not necessarily see in the alternative history field in certain areas. And will mention that there was a mummy that was in the news recently, which I'm not going to name where from, where the results and the scientific analysis of may not have been as upfront as what you're doing here, and. Mm-hmm. I know that there are individuals, and when I was talking about with certain friends of mine that we were doing this show, and I'd mentioned it, and some of them half pay attention to what I'm doing, and some people immediately jump to the ancient aliens answer, and they say, well, it's not aliens. Well, why does it have to be aliens? Why can't it be a branch of non-Homo sapiens in the line that we haven't discovered yet? Why can't we have mm-hmm. very intelligent and people of ingenuity from ancient times and from even deep antiquity that we may not have discovered or known about yet?
Well, that's a great point. And it's with the discovery of Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon and Florensis from Indonesia and the Denisovans, what it shows us is that Homo sapiens sapiens is a very nasty species of being, and anybody who has any territory has a tendency to lose the territory and lose their lives. So that's the theory we're working on. It's quite clear that the little Florensis people of Indonesia were wiped out by Homo sapiens sapiens. Probably Neanderthal was as well. Denisovans probably as well. So it is quite possible, and that's why the results are going to be quite fascinating. With the team of experts we have, I think there are 8 of us giving talks on February 2nd, to see the possibility that maybe the Paracas were a subspecies of humanity that had to escape their territory because they were under attack. Naturally, if you're able to and close to the ocean, you leave by some kind of boat to get away, and then you wander until you can find a new homeland. And that's the theory I'm working on and have been for 2 or 3 years, was that they were outcasts and they had to re-establish themselves. When they found the coast of Peru here, there was basically nobody living here, so it was perfect for them. And for some reason, the Paracas were absolute experts at desert agriculture. So in some ways, I think that's a connection to the Middle East, because we have thousands of date palms that nobody could explain where they came from. They produce 50 to 100 pounds of dates each. The dates drop on the ground and rot. Nobody collects them. So the standard story is that the Spanish brought them, but there's no historical record of anybody ever using them for anything. But dates to a Middle Eastern society, and the date palm is an incredibly sacred, complicated, useful plant.
I have family that live in the Algarve, and I spent a week up there when I brought my wife there to propose to her. And my friend had a date tree in his garden, and we would regularly in the morning just go out and collect the dates that were there and use it for breakfast. So the fact that these aren't being collected, it doesn't seem to what you're indicating doesn't seem to have it necessarily ingrained within their culture. Or within the tradition to say, okay, well, you've got dates here, let's eat them. It's more of a nuisance, not necessarily a food. So
yeah. That's a historical mystery that I'm trying to, and it's only one characteristic of these ancient people that is very fascinating. They were also incredible masters of making very thin pottery, mm-hmm. As if made on a potter's wheel. No. Mesoamerican people are supposed to have ever known the potter's wheel. The potter's wheel was invented in the Middle East. They also knew how to tie dye, which, you know, is something which doesn't fit in. The royal people lived in underground houses. And I think the reasoning for that is that it It rains half an inch of year or half an inch of a year in Paracas. And so I honestly think they had lighter skin and had to live underground in order to keep from being burnt on a daily basis. But the other anomalies just keep going on and on and on. And there's no academic I know of that's actually looking at this stuff.
Well, you're the only one. You are the main face of the South American the South American mystery or cultural mystery, which is unfortunately a lot of it had been wiped out based on the Spanish conquistadors traveling to South America. So mm-hmm. I know that with the Maya, a lot of their history mm-hmm. was actually written down while the Holocaust, and to be honest, it was a Holocaust with millions of people upon that were devastated by their coming to this continent. That it was actually written down afterwards through the oral tradition because it had to be. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known anything. Uh-huh. So even with the oral traditions that are there now, what oral traditions are the locals saying about the skulls themselves? And how did you get permission to actually examine them?
Well, the great thing is that because I was fascinated by the skulls, after my first trip to Paracas, we were only there for 3 days, I think. And the weather here is just so wonderful that my wife and I, after a period of time, decided that Lima sucks as a place to live because it's a population of 11 million people. It's just, you know, it's quite awful, most of it, some nice neighborhoods. But we decided, well, why don't we spend more time in Paracas? And then I became the assistant director of the museum. Senior Juan Navarro and I would constantly go out in the field because he had been studying this stuff for more than 40 years, and he knew every location of every Paracas settlement. So over the course of about 7 years, we visited every single site. In some cases, we found some artifacts for the museum. But yeah, it's just because I'm as curious as a cat, and because there almost is no literature whatsoever about these people, I just decided, well, maybe I can figure out, you know, what's going on with this. And then through connecting with Ellie Marzulli, who was able to get someone to donate $100,000 to do the DNA testing, you know, on and on it goes, that, you know, that's we're in the position we're in because we have access to great people like Ellie Marzulli, and also the local people who still remember certain aspects of the history. So it's like weaving an ancient story back together again in the field. It's a lot of fun for me.
I know that I watched the video, and the video was just released about an hour before you and I connected on Skype.
Right.
Can you give me a brief rundown of the process that you used, or at least the scientific process that you used to document the analysis?
Okay. Well, that's a great point because there's been almost zero carbon-14 testing of artifacts of the Paracas. Peru doesn't have great forensic stuff, neither does Bolivia. So what happened was with the initial samples, four samples that we had tested, and that was by permission from Senior Juan, who owns a private museum, which is a private collection, then that drew worldwide attention. And so we decided, well, four samples is not a good sample size. We need like 50, 30, 40, 50 or something. So we contacted the Ministry of Culture of Peru and said that we wanted to do some DNA studies. We would finance the whole thing. And so Dr. Ruben Soto accepted our offer. I asked him two simple questions. I said, do you know where the Paracas came from? And do you know why they had red hair? And he said, no. I said, well, if we do scientific analysis, we can find out for you. You can be in charge of the study. And so he said, okay. And so he actually is in charge of the DNA testing process. So it's a Peruvian working for the Peruvian government, and the results go to the Peruvian government after the release of the on February the 2nd. So after a 30-month process of paperwork, we got permission to take samples. And so LA and his forensic crew and film crew came down and they took samples from multiple skulls in the Ica Regional Museum and also the little Paracas, private museum of Senior Navarro, and took them back and submitted them to two laboratories, two of the top 10 in the world, one in Canada and one in California. And so it's been a process of a lot of money, a lot of retesting, because some of the samples were so badly degraded they had to enhance them, which cost a lot more money. But that's why we're very happy to announce that we have sufficient data now for a global release on February the 2nd. And so that's why the 6-minute video is like the initial teaser for giving people an indication of what's coming.
Now, the interesting thing that I found, and I'm not going to say it's interesting, the noble thing that I found is that admission to this symposium, it's free. You're not charging anybody to actually see these results. And again, Friday, February the 2nd, so everyone can cut out of work early out in the Pacific Coast, 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. And that's at the Marriott in Los Angeles, actually at the Los Angeles airport, 585.
Yeah.
So I've been there, I think, or at least I've been nearby. I've gone from one, from one airport to the other to Bradley. Love L.A. The weather's fantastic, especially coming from, you know, a place where it's minus 46 sometimes. you're out from the West Coast. Like you grew up in BC. I'm not sure if you've ever been to Ottawa before. It's
oh yes, I have. my sister lives there.
Oh well, there you go. Well, then you know exactly how bloody cold it can get out here. next time you're down, I'll make sure I can get you a Tim's so people acclimate you to the weather.
That's good. Well. That's why Canadians are tough people.
Well, and you know the tough people who ask tough questions, and I'm very grateful that you are taking the time this afternoon. Normally, we'd be able to ask some questions of the audience. Obviously, since this is pre-recorded, I have people who are absolutely flabbergasted, and they're like, Chris, we know you're going to answer all the good ones. So for anybody who is if I am getting some in, I'm still waiting for a couple. So I'm going to be able to circle back to that one aspect which I touched on earlier, which was the connection between Rapa Nui and Göbekli Tepe. When you first saw the designs of the stones at Göbekli Tepe and saw that they were anthropomorphic and saw the hand placement, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
The indication to me is that they're referencing the source. Quite often in places. For example, the name of Cusco means the navel of the world. Rapa Nui's proper translation, which is Te Pito o Te Henawa, means the navel of the world, meaning that was where the culture evolved from, or that was the central focus of the culture. So that was my initial impression, is that just like us, our navel was connected, that's where we come out of mom, connected. That I think that's, to me, is the cultural reference that they're referring to.
And this is going to, I know it's a very short question for a very complicated answer, possibly. But do you think that there is a connection between Göbekli Tepe and Easter Island?
No. The problem is that I haven't been yet to Göbekli Tepe. They shut it down about 6 months ago, and they put a roof on it, and supposedly it's opening up again soon, and ISIS was pretty close, to it. But within the next couple of years, through Patricia Awian in Egypt of the Kemet School, I think we're going to organize a tour there, which would be great. Because I tend not to try to discuss places I've never been to, mm-hmm. because the difference between looking at a picture or a video or reading a book and being there in real life is like completely different. So I'm going to have to wait before I can make any kind of comparison.
And that would go to your credibility as a researcher, without making any wild speculation. I know that at least, and again, I've never been to either place myself. I know that there is, I'm trying to remember the name of the lost civilization from the subcontinent. It's slipping my mind. I can't believe this. from India. The Indus Valley Civilization.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
There were indications from certain individuals that I knew, and I'm trying to remember if it was Laird Scranton himself or if it was somebody else who had actually told me who knew Laird. I think it was actually John Michael Greer, who is an alternative history researcher. He's also kind of one of the world's if you need to know about esoteric symbolism, you ask him. He's a former arch druid. He's a 32nd degree Freemason. This is stuff he's been doing for 20 years now. And he had indicated that the language that is found in the Indus Valley actually may have a connection to the Rongo Rongo script in Easter Island. And I'm not sure if this is something you've looked into yourself, because you've spoken on the script extensively yourself. What have you seen as far as similarities to other scripts? And have you been told what they actually say? Have you asked very nicely and gently to the native peoples of the area what that script actually may mean?
As far as I know, none of them know what it means. And visiting Rapa Nui is fascinating because, again, those that know stuff, if you can get them in your confidence, they tell you the most amazing stuff. No archaeologist has ever, as far as I know, interviewed any of the native people of the island. So that's pissed off the people of Rapa Nui. But if you do look at the symbolism, Rongo Rongo looks really similar to that of the Indus Valley. And then again, when you get into the idea that when Van Roggeveen arrived on the island, who named it Easter Island, one of his crew members' descriptions of the people was, there are tall people and short people, dark-skinned people and light-skinned people, black-haired people, red-haired people, and blonde-haired people. So the original inhabitants of that area obviously were a very complex mix of different. They weren't just the Polynesians. There was somebody else was there or others, and so again, when you have that connection with Persia and people from Easter Island, or sorry, from New Zealand, then I think it's very possible that ancient people from the Indus Valley somehow made it into Polynesia and wound up on Easter Island, maybe as a refuge. And I think they brought their script with them. But then they may have died off. And then the symbolism or meaning could have either changed or been reinterpreted. But I do think there was a connection. Too often people say, well, there's a symbol of a snake in England, and there's a symbol of a snake in India. They must be connected. It's like, there's too much of that going on. But I think the Indus Valley connection is quite plausible.
And one of the questions I'm receiving is with regards to something that you may have presented at one point or another in the past. And this was with regards to the Viracocha symbolism, specifically the jaguar style tears, which some people have said represents crying for a lost land. I know that you believe that to be something, or at least at one point, to believe that to be something different. Have you looked into that yourself? And have you come to a more clear answer on that?
Yeah, the symbolism at Pumapunku and Tiwanaku, which is where you find most of the symbols of Viracocha, most of them are so badly eroded that it's difficult to make out the, specifically what you're looking at. Those appeared actually in the few decent pieces of sculpture that still exist that are in half good shape because of the climate, the age, etc. They appear to be the eyes appear to be the shape of puma's heads, and then you see those dots coming down. Whether the dots are tears or not, I'm not sure. David Childress believes that it's Viracocha weeping for the lost red land, which could be either Atlantis or Mu. But for me, I'm not quite sure yet.
And I know that there is some symbolism in Egypt which has signified, elongated skulls, and the actual mummies themselves didn't necessarily show the same form of the head. Mm-hmm. What are some of the indications that you found from your own analysis and from documenting the elongated skulls that differentiate themselves from our own?
You mean the ones in Paracas?
In Paracas, yes.
Yeah. Well, the depiction of elongated heads in Egypt are during the Amarna period, which of course is Akhenaten. He was very much an adept at ancient knowledge. So I think he was doing that to say, this is where we come from. Not that I look like that, but this is where we come from. Of course, his mummy has never been found. Nefertiti's has never been found. But the physical characteristics, which are fascinating among the percentage of Paracas which appear to be natural looking, are that there is no suture line here. Like, we all have a suture across this way and coming back that way in a T-shape. This suture is not there. So that has, that's been a fascination to 30 plus doctors that I've physically shown them to here from the US and Canada and Europe, et cetera. Another aspect is that the eye sockets are 50% larger than normal, and also the foramen magnum, which is where your vertebral column and spinal cord go through in the bottom of your skull, it's so far back that that is a genetic difference, and that could, or I think obviously is why, nature did that because the skulls have a tendency to be cone head shaped and would tend to pivot backwards. And so in order to compensate for that, nature made the that hole in the bottom of the skulls of the Paracas farther back. There are also two holes in the back of the skull, which are called foramen, and that's where blood and nerve flow would come out in order to feed the upper part of the skull. And there are other characteristics which are going to be discussed during the conference on February the 2nd by other experts. Supposedly there are nervous system differences on the face, which would indicate that their facial expressions were not the same as ours. Hmm. Like they couldn't smile and frown. They didn't have the same range of facial expressions that we have, which sounds kind of like an alien characteristic to me from watching a lot of B movies. But there are a number of subtleties. Also, there are little bones in the back of the head, which only the Royal Inca supposedly had. And so that could be a genetic connection with the Inca too. And the early accounts of the Inca are that they were a royal family of people with red hair.
Well, that's one interesting part about the Inca, because people tend to think that the Inca were that was the name of the entire civilization and all the people that were there, when in fact it was supposed to have been referred to, the Inca were supposed to have been referred to the royal family or the royal line. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It was only the royal bloodline. So, and their origins, archaeologists will tell you, they don't know exactly where they came from. There's some history in Lake Titicaca, but it's not 100%. But also the Royal Inca had elongated heads. I've seen the skulls. So yeah, the Inca themselves were a population of, at the peak, of maybe 1,000 people who had all the high positions, as in the high Inca who was the ruler, then the high priest was an Inca, and the general or the highest in the military was an Inca, and the general population of 15 million people were of many different cultures and genetic backgrounds.
Now, this will be a good question for you, and I think it may have been one that I don't think you have been asked at any conference so far. Knowing the difference between an actual elongated skull and one that had head bindings, and if have you been able to differentiate between the classes, and if so, have you found a larger number of bound heads in the lower classes within that culture versus the actual elongated skulls, which were supposed to have been the ruling class?
Well, no, all of at least in the Paracas culture here, the only people with elongated heads were the nobility, like the chiefly the chiefs, the religious or spiritual leaders, etc. The commoners are all normal looking, because I've seen numerous graves of common people in this area, as compared to the royal cemeteries, where only the elongated skull people were buried. But it depends. The interesting thing is, at the last stages of the Paracas culture, that's when we have the introduction of what are called the Nazca people, famous for the lines and geoglyphs, but they were normal-looking people. So the theory I'm working on now is that the Nazca invaded and wiped out the royal class people, because the red hair disappears when you get into the Nazca period, the tallness disappears, and the red hair, the elongated skulls, and the tallness disappear as you get into the Nazca culture. And also their textiles and ceramics are inferior too. So that indicates to me genocide.
Would this also account for why the Nazca lines may have been done after or at least what you had termed a homing beacon, which seems to have been one of the larger geoglyphs on that side of the continent, which is essentially the same as the Southern Cross, but a mirror image of it. Was that made before the Nazca lines, by this line of thinking, or were they made around the same time and then they came in and wiped them out?
No, that's a great point. The Nazca figures, the lines and the geoglyphs, were made over the course of 1,000 years. So they were started in about 500 BC by the Paracas. They made the candelabra, which is 500 feet tall. They also made the astronaut, which is the one waving in the sky. And they made more than 1,000 geoglyphs in between Paracas and Nazca that most people have never heard of. Then you have about 30 or so of the famous ones, aside from the astronaut, that were made by the Nazca people between 100 and 600 AD.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm just making a last round of, are there any questions you want me to ask while I've got you on the line to our adepts? Lee, who just joined us late, he says, sorry, I'm late. So if anybody does have any questions that you want to be able to ask, I can ask Brian now. And while those are going on, two questions I do have, which is in regards to your tours. How do people sign up to them? How does somebody get involved? And if somebody's not in LA, because trust me, I looked into it, I can't be there. How do we watch?
Well, in terms of the tours, my website, of which 95% of the content is free information. I'd like to change it from hiddenincatours.com. I'd like to change the name because less of it has to do with tours anymore, but it's difficult to change the name of a website when it's been ingrained in people's heads. So that's where you find the tours that we do. We're actually going to Easter Island in October, so people, if they want to, can join up for that for a week. But that's where the tours are located. But as I said, 95% of the content is videos and articles and interviews like this, etc., that are 100% free. And then I forget what the second half of the question was.
Which would be the symposium on the second. Is there a way for those who are not in LA to view this live?
LA Marzulli looked into that, and it just wasn't feasible to do a live broadcast of it, unfortunately. So we're going to be doing it in a conference room, and the whole thing is going to be filmed by Richard Shaw, I believe, who's the director, master cameraman of the Watchers series that he and L.A. Marzulli did. And so they're going to produce a DVD that will be available to the general public. And it won't be very expensive. But we have to charge a fee for it because the DNA testing cost more than $100,000. So I will be posting on my website more and more information as regards the results. As I said earlier, I haven't seen them, the results yet. because I'm very bad at releasing free information to the public, and some people don't that I work with don't like that. But the results should be or will be very fascinating. That's why LA is making a big deal out of this. And then we're also hoping to sell enough DVDs to be able to conduct a dig here in Paracas, because we've located the 10-acre area where the largest elongated skulls in the world have been found. And so we're hoping to do a dig with the Ministry of Culture of Peru, with our head archaeologist here being the man in charge of that procedure.
And one of our illustrious masters is asking me, what's the cranial volume of the elongated skulls compared to a regular normal skull?
Well, we're going to have to do a lot more measurements of those. That's why I'm hoping to get access to the collection in the Ica Regional Museum, because the Paracas Museum has 45 skulls of different sizes and shapes. Some are natural. Most of them are cranial deformation, but we have found anomalies of as much as 25 to 30% larger cranial volume in the Paracas skulls. But if we're able to access larger collection, I think we might find even greater differences.
Okay, and I think I am getting one more question in here, and I do apologize. We always seem to get the flood at the end, as they say. But while I'm looking for a few, because I'm getting them through several different communications aspects, one of our listeners is asking your opinion on Tom DeLonge and his To the Stars Academy. I know it's not necessarily your field of research, but have you heard of it, and what do you think?
No, I've actually never heard of that.
Oh, okay. Well, then, Lee, I guess that is your answer for that.
Sorry.
Let's see. I've got just now. Okay, I know that we're going a little bit over on the time, and I did want to thank you very much. I know you're a very busy guy, especially with all the planning that you have, and packing can take a while with your travels that are coming up. So I did want to thank you very much for your time while we sign off. And again, if you just want to wait off just a few moments while I play us out, as it were, with some good music, and one I probably haven't played in a while. Let's see. This is usually what I do for... What? Where's Scattered Knowledge? Oh, for crying out loud. Oh, here's a good one. This is actually from a group called Lobo Lobo, and it's What Was In My Head. I'll use that as kind of an appropriate outro music. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Chris George Zuger and Brian Forrester. This is The Den of Lore. This will be released to the general public next week. And as this is the pre-record, thank you for our adepts for joining us and asking the lovely questions of Brian. I will see you guys this Friday for a live regular show.